Congratulations, introduce the minister to us, please, and congratulations to both of you for being appointed on the portfolio.
Thank you for the question. Thank you, Mr. President, and welcome you. We hope it's going to be nice working with you and the team of the committee. Next to me is the Minister of Public Enterprise, Comrade Barbara Olney.
Thank you very much. Today's meeting, as it reflects on the ATC, we have the department here who are going to brief us on their budget and strategic plan. I will now hand over to the DG to introduce herself and her team.
Thank you, Chair. From the department, I think if it would be okay with you, Chair, so that we save time, is that the various deputy director generals are going to make presentations on their units, so when they present, they can introduce themselves. So what I'll just do is introduce briefly the people on us. I'm Portia Munich, the Director General, and at the end is Swazi Dagai, who is currently working in Parliamentary Services. Sam just walked out, he was next to her. Ayanda Shezi is our communications head. Samida Mohammed is the manager in my office. Shireen Crossan is our head of corporate services. And Jen Hutchings is the chief financial officer for the department. And then everybody else will talk and they will introduce themselves at the same time. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Isang is circulating the attendance list, isn't it? Okay. Thanks. I hand over to you, Minister, and your team to present before the committee the strategic plan and the budget. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair. Firstly, let me congratulate you for your appointment to this position. I think it's a very welcome appointment to a seasoned parliamentarian, and we really will be able to keep us on our toes as your role mate. I also want to say that I'm very pleased that we are able to start now with a parliamentary session with a detailed a review of our strategic plan going forward for the next year. It will give the members of this committee an opportunity to start really engaging with the real issues that are facing us in state-owned enterprises and in our department as our role as a shareholder here. You will guide us. We have brought a lot of details here. I've requested that our presenters here have an executive summary, but also have attached to that executive summary a lot of detail. So it will allow for people who want to carry on with the detail to go into that detail, but we didn't want to swamp you. I mean, this is a huge amount of information. We didn't want to swap you completely, so we wanted to give you enough detail to follow on, but not to take up all the time. So, you know, there are, of course, burning issues that are facing us at the moment that are right out in the media. I'm sure that some of that will come up in the hearings that we have at the moment. We welcome those being raised because we can, I think it's a useful opportunity for us to respond to some of these issues. But let me just say in conclusion then that most of these state-owned enterprises in which we exercise as government oversight in terms of being the shareholders are essential for our economy. They provide the economic backbone and infrastructure for economy to be able to operate, from rail, freight, to the harbors, to the ports, to the energy requirements of this country. If it were not for them, we would not be able to operate. So whilst it might not mean that compared to when I was Minister of Health, when we were engaged in a crisis every hour, so whilst it may not mean that we are on the ground, as it were, in service delivery, these state-owned enterprises, because of the essential role they play in the economy, are absolutely critical to our country. Not only that, the amount of their budgets are huge, and therefore our responsibility as a department is very, very serious. We have to make sure that we provide some of the essential, make sure that some of the essential infrastructure for economy is there, but we also have to take note of the huge budgets that we're dealing with. So with that, I think both the Deputy Minister and myself are looking forward in our new positions. We've been engaging very seriously with the department. We've been getting a lot of briefings from the department. We've been engaging already with some of the CEOs of the various state-owned enterprises. And so we're looking forward to moving with this department, with the formidable responsibilities that it carries. And we thank you for convening this meeting so that we can start explaining exactly what our engagement is going to be for the coming year.
Thank you very much, Minister and Deputy Minister. I will map out the way I think we should conduct this meeting. But firstly, I want to say that it should not happen again that we receive the documents for the meeting, the day of the meeting, the hour of the meeting. It's not very helpful. I know we are all running against time and all those things, so I regret and I apologize to all of us. And I hope that from the department side and the ministry side, we will do better next time. Thanks. I think that we must give you a little bit of free hand to take us through in the manner in which you think it's best to take us through, as long as by the end of the day we have seriously engaged your strat plan and your budget proposal. But I also think that the issues that you are saying are pertinent and are burning issues that are out there in the public. We cannot run away from them if they emerge, and we should create space to deal with them also in the city. And both you, Minister and Deputy Minister, and the department should tell us when you have a total answer or where you have but I think you should make a serious attempt to provide answers to all the questions that will emerge today. But if there are those that you think you can provide fuller answers later on when we meet again, please indicate that. So I will give you leeway in terms of taking us through the meeting in terms of the budget, the agenda item. But we will also create room when we engage you and space for us to freely ask you the questions, even if they might not be the questions directly related to the strategic plan, which are especially issues related to pertinent burning issues that the public wants answers to. Thank you. Over to you, Minister, and you will lead us in terms of how you take the process forward.
Thank you. I'd like to hand over then to our DG, Portia Monefi, and then the various DDGs who are responsible for various aspects will then carry also the presentation forward.
Thank you, Chair. Apologies for the lateness, but it's also been a bit difficult in terms of the timing that we were given. But as a matter of course, we will be trying to make sure that we get all the documentation a week prior to the date. The structure of the presentation, I won't bore you to go through the details, but the various ends of the presentation are appropriately labeled to cover these various issues that are indicated in the content. We are responsible for 9 state-owned enterprises, beginning with ELEFCO, which is the diamond mine in the Northern Cape. There's both ELEFCO, which is basically a fiber optic cable company, which is basically a wholesaler in the economy, both nationally, and has now started building an undersea cable in consortium with other private operators. There's Denel, which is a defense company. Eskom is the energy, is electricity utility, but we all know. Cable Bed Modular Reactor, basically a project company and a technology company. There's the Russian Forestry Company Limited, SAFCO, which is the small forestry company that is still within the state and is subject of a final decision on a disposal or with a holding by the state in one form or the other. Then the South African Airways, South African Express, and then and Transnet. We thought we would just show the relative size of the portfolio with respect to the asset base of the companies. By far the largest is Eskom with 171 billion of assets. Following that is Transnet with 98 billion. Quite a distant third is SAA at 17.5 billion. And then after that would then be Denel, the defense company. Safco, and that really is a function of the accounting treatment of forests, generally the revaluations that happen. And then in almost similar size would be Broadband Infraco, South African Express, and PDMR. PDMR remains quite small in terms of asset base because at this particular juncture what you would have installed would be the test facilities by and large, and then some manufacturing that had already started. And they score quite small at 418 million. And that you'd know from its history where there has been a significant underperformance by the company whilst the settlement agreement was being reached. And now, as part of implementation of the settlement agreement, we're moving towards a company that is able to operate on a 51% state ownership and 49% community. The other company that we don't own 100% is Broadband Infraco, where 26% of the company is owned by the IBC. The role of the department remains one to ensure that the SOEs are efficiently managed and that in terms of performance is benchmarked both to domestic and international industry operational benchmarks. We also want to ensure that the SOEs do not crowd out private sector players by ensuring that the state stays in the point in the sector where the state ownership is critical and that the private sector is able to come in and play their role in that sector. In the sense of the investment program, what you want to try, and we use advisedly the term reserve margin because as you know, reserve margin relates to the electricity system. However, in the rest of the network industries, what you try to create is invest sufficiently so that there are no bottlenecks, infrastructure bottlenecks in the economy, so there's room for growth and room to continue the expansion program of the infrastructure. And then also to ensure that in as far as is possible to a competitive basis point, the investment program of the state-owned enterprises is leveraged for industrial investment in the economy in South Africa as well as on the continent going forward on a sustainable basis. So our role by and large is to make sure that we balance out the two interests, both the interests of the enterprise on the one hand and the national interest on the other side, on the other hand. Sometimes these come very close to being points of conflict, but on the enterprise side, it's to ensure that the enterprise is sustainable on a financial basis, that it has a solid balance sheet, because an enterprise with a weak balance sheet is not able to, at the very least, the basic, provide the infrastructure on a competitive basis. And the next level over and above that is to then ensure that it is providing that infrastructure or that service in a manner that's beneficial to the economy. And then also to ensure that the enterprise can focus on its core on its core business. Now, what does it becomes, and what's actually crucial in this case, is that the shareholder has got to be absolutely clear about what is critical performance indicators for that enterprise so that you don't give mixed signals. On the other hand of that, is the national interest. And the national interest is to ensure that there is sufficient investment to catalyze economic growth, that there is efficiency in the provision of the service. Because the problem with inefficiencies is not so much the fact that you limit the ability of the economy to compete with other economies, but the other fact is that you can actually also have inefficiencies in the investment, where you end up investing much more than what you would if the service was provided on a more efficient basis. And then be ensuring that as much as possible in the procurement of the SMEs, there is manufacturing capability being generated in South Africa and jobs as well. In fact, the point about the national interest is that quite a lot of effort has gone to get the SMEs to a point where they understand that some of the issues that are raised as national interest questions are actually crucial for them as companies themselves. What has, in the last financial year, I think we've had to deal a lot more with this question of what's the role of the shareholder, what's the role of the board, and what's the role of management in an enterprise. as part of the shareholder, the role of the shareholder is to ensure that we appoint boards. So it's critical that the board is a strong board. And there's also, in the appointment of the board, that the shareholder has a clear strategic intent or is clear about the strategic direction that their enterprise needs to follow as it implements the plans of the company. The board is the next level, which is actually responsible for approving the strategy of the company and ensures that the strategy is coherent and that management efforts are clearly directed towards the implementation of the strategy as well as whatever the business plan, and that reporting is accurate. If you've ever sat on the board and if you've studied governance, you'll know that this remains a big question because of the point of information asymmetry, and that is always going to be there. And then management is then responsible for the formulation and implementation of the company's strategy and business plan. A key point which we've found needs to be emphasized is that there's always an understanding that the shareholder owns the assets of the company. The assets of the company are owned by the company, not by the shareholder. The shareholder owns the shares in that company, and it's only on liquidation that the assets would revert back to the shareholder. We think that it's actually quite critical that this distinction is clear, because more often it's been a point that we had to go through as a department as well, so that we get to a point where we understand that we intervene at a point, and after a point we stand back, because then it would be micromanaging the enterprise. However, in certain instances, when there's really a crisis, there is an expectation that the shareholder will intervene much deeper than what would be the case under normal circumstances. So how the management process would normally run itself, the shareholder needs to issue a strategic statement of national intent. Why do you own the enterprise? What is it expected to do? Then the next level from that strategic intent is a definition of key performance indicators, which are ensure that when the company and the board in directing management set up their strategy, there is alignment between the strategy that's developed by the company and the board and the strategic intent of the shareholder. In these areas, we set financial indicators, operational indicators, investment, not to an extensive extent, so I'll come back on that because that might be not entirely true. And then points around supplier development. So supplier development, when we're actually quite clear, is that when you undertake a particular investment program, you must ensure that you are building the South African supply base. If you recall from last year, at least the members of the press who are in the room, when we've indicated that some SOEs have applied to use the competitive supply development program and yet others haven't, and the tendency has been to grant that right to the companies which have long-term investment programs, because one of the things that is found is that it's critical for the private sector to have a sense that there's indeed a long program that is attached to whatever, so that it de-risks the investments that they need to undertake on the industrial side. Why I say investment is not really our space, because if only the company that knows the balance sheet, and they're the ones who know what the balance sheet is able to carry. So they would put out a proposal on what they are able to invest, and on the back of that the shareholder then makes comments on whether it's sufficient. Do we think that we should be investing in another area and create scope for private sector participation? Or then do we then go back into the system and say we have a bit of a problem if you're not meeting all of the investment required for that particular sector? A lot of this stuff around the investment does require significant dialogue with the sector departments. For example, the Department of Transport would have a national freight strategy, I think it's written, I can't quite remember the name that they use for it, which would indicate the comprehensive investment program for the transport sector. The Department of Energy now, and previously Department of Mineral and Energy, would have set up the Energy Master Plan, which would be the comprehensive investment program that's required for energy. Eskom would then go and put together an investment program on the back of what is Eskom's role in that. And if you recall, we had indicated that at least 70% of the build will be undertaken by Eskom, and the balance would be ICT going forward. We then use this to develop key performance indicators which would go into the shareholder contact. And what we're trying to do is increasingly align the signing date of these contacts with as early as possible in the beginning of the financial year, as opposed to around the AGM versus currently the tendency. And then on the back of that, when we receive the business plan for the SOE, we ensure that the business plan does align with the KPIs, and then that then basically becomes the basis on which we do ongoing performance assessments of the SOEs. in effect, what we should be trying to do, Chair, is that by the time the SOEs come and present their annual business plan to you, we must have gone through the context for each of the SOEs so that you are clear about the areas of performance that they should have achieved, so that when they present, you're able to ask questions if there is any variance between the two. So in terms of, as we see our role, the DPE has a responsibility to ensure that we are meeting security of supply. This is a challenging position to be in because sometimes we are seen as a service provider of last resort. And a service provider of last resort tends to get a fair amount of underutilized or under watching, for want of a better word, because invariably, in good times, you tend to think that everything is fine and you don't focus on that enterprise. It's only in bad times that you suddenly remember that actually your service provider is a state-owned enterprise, and so the under-attention that's been given creates its own problem. And the under-attention can be in as far as what's the extent of capitalization that you've provided for the company. I think there'll be more than enough experience that comes out of the ESCOM history, where you move from excess capacity, you get to a point where you have a tight constraint situation, and by the time you have tight constraints, your previous policy position of bringing in the private sector is directly in conflict with having to move quite quickly at the same time. So I do think that that's an area which does create a fair amount of tension. The second point is facilitating the development of advanced manufacturing capabilities resulting from the investment programs of the SOEs, and being quite cautious that all of the investments that the SOEs undertake are indeed required by the economy and actually have to be undertaken by the state and not the private sector. Because each time the state undertakes an investment, you're moving money that could have been used for something else into what could actually, if there was a private sector player who would participate in that area. And then also, as a matter of principle, and this is basic economics, is that the state always plays where there are market failures and regulation failures as well. And this tends to be in network infrastructure. I know some of the statements that I've made put me, and Andrew will have to deal a lot more with those questions when he talks about SAA, because there is a tendency in South Africa to treat SAA not as a network company, because it doesn't, at first blush, seem to be the case. But in our opinion, if you are a country that's located at an end hemisphere, aviation is as much an important transport mode as your rail and as your seaport services. And I think, Chair, over time, and even at the Autumn School, you get to understand in terms of you look at transport costs in South Africa, when you look even at the physical infrastructure, the rail and the general logistics system, 57% of our costs are not in South Africa. 67% are actually the shipping costs and the rest of the life. So to have your own ability to have aviation is actually quite crucial. We may, and maybe not now, but in the future days, when we talk about the extent of international services provided to South Africa. And in the last period when we've gone through an economic downturn, we'll also be able to show you how much capacity has been cut by foreign carriers, and yet we've had to continue to provide services, because if we cut down services with SAA, you would then have the South African economy increasingly closer from the international market. We also then, and this is probably, it's almost secondary, and it's secondary in as far as our core role is to ensure that the SOEs are efficient, they've got strong balance sheets, and that wherever they are to procure, they're procuring as much as is possible from the South African economy, which helps to build the industrial base. However, what we also have to ensure is that when SOEs do undertake an investment program, and I'm talking really to this second bullet point, is that there is alignment between the investment program of the SOE beyond the supply industry to the industrial policy of the DPI, as well as to the innovation strategy of the Department of Science and Technology, so that in all of our actions we continue to drive forward the national agenda of the government. Increasingly as well, we have to ensure that state-owned enterprises are investing in rural areas and that they are getting into secondary towns and rural towns. Now, in the case of ESCOM, this is the electrification program. However, the electrification program is not directly under our direct control. It's DME, Minister of Department of Energy now, as well as the new Department of local governments, provincial governments and local affairs, who would then determine where the electrification and how much money is actually allocated for electrification, and Eskom is basically a service provider as far as that's concerned. In the case of branch network, Eskom is now, Transnet has now worked on a strategy to revive the branch railway lines, particularly in secondary towns where they are, where there's genuine economic activity. It would be remiss not to indicate that one of the most important challenges that we face right now is to ensure that we, all of the SOEs, are able to implement the infrastructure investment programs that are planned in the current, not only global context, but also in the South African context. Because in the South African context, there have been significant revenue downturns in virtually all of the SOEs, and the revenue forecasts are actually quite an important source of revenue for the investment funding for the investment program itself. Secondly, in the global markets, the credit markets are actually getting quite tight, are quite tight. We're in a bit of a fortuitous situation in that increasingly creditors are preferring state-owned enterprises because they know that's the backing of the state. So it then becomes important that the rating of the company stays fairly strong and remains strong because, in effect, they're not only betting on the enterprise, they're increasingly betting on the states that we come from. So it's actually quite important that we ensure that as we go ahead, and the challenge now that we face with the Eskom application, is that regulators must be seen by funders as coherent, and policy must be increasingly seen as clear and stable going forward. Chair, I'm not doing the whole presentation. I'll stop when I get to organizational structure, and then we can discuss. So this is the first part of the talking to the strategy of the department. Sorry. The next part, Chair, really was to talk to what would be the government's program of action. And these are the projects that get run in partnership with other government departments. The Department of Public Enterprises and the Department of Transport and the ministers of the two departments are the co-chairs of the newly formed infrastructure development cluster. So as part of the infrastructure development cluster, we've got quite a few projects that we would be directly responsible for as the department, but also some that we participate in partnership with the others. Some really exciting projects, actually, which I think, if implemented appropriately, not only have the benefit of speeding up the investment in infrastructure, but also have the benefit of ensuring that there's greater efficiency. So the first one is the project that we will do in alignment with all of the other infrastructure providers is to ensure that critical infrastructure reaches prioritized small rural towns which have mining activities, agriculture sector, tourism, as well as council industry. Our contribution really here is over and above the electrification program, is the Transnet program strategy to revive rural rail links in branch lines. Quite a lot of questions around how you ensure that these are efficient, and also the strategy that Transnet is producing is actually quite exciting in as far as it does generally start to create an opportunity for small rail operators to enter the system going forward. The second project is around some sort of a protocol which will ensure the joint utilization of servitude, not only by state-owned enterprises, but also by other levels of government when building new infrastructure. So, for example, if you're planning to run a transmission line, not good idea, to run a fiber network, you're building a pipeline, and there's a road as well, and the servitudes are quite close. Normally what would happen, if I don't have a servitude and I want to put in a new fiber cable, as would often be the case with Infraco, the new player in the block, we would have to go and apply for servitudes and try and secure land ourselves. What we're trying to do this way is that if you can get Sunrail to let you participate, share in their servitude, you then effectively short-circuit part of the process, which actually does sometimes take a very long time. And so you effectively cease the process and you also reduce the cost. It's a protocol that we're going to develop the same participation with other government departments as we go forward. The strategically important development is something that we began in DPA probably two or three years ago, and this was an attempt to get EIA's fast track for Eskom and Transnet. And we've done sort of really good work and worked quite well with the Department of Environment and Tourism on putting in a guideline for this, which then gets very big strategic projects, infrastructure projects, into the system so that they can be tracked from the national and they move them out from just provincial watch, because sometimes what we find is that EIAs will get blocked inside the province and not really at the national level, and there's not enough oversight. We will see with the restructuring of departments, because this then would be one of those areas that moves into the uniform Department of Environmental or what this is, that would get formulated going forward. Another very important project, which we also do in partnership with other departments, is looking for alternative funding mechanisms to continue with the infrastructure build program. There's actually quite a lot of care that needs to be taken as far as that's concerned, because in some instances, some funding sources limit what you're able to do with the build program for industrialization purposes. For example, if you get export credit financing, which is funding by the home country of your supplier, there are very clear rules about how much manufacturing must happen in their home country and not in South Africa, which then limits how much local content you are able to do. But if you don't have money, you are in a bit of a tight spot. So quite a lot of work is going into that. In the case of broadband, InfoCo is really going to be watching the submarine cable, and by and large, this is functioning, doesn't need much attention from outside, but just to make sure that we meet all of the deadlines that have been set. The investment program, really, by Eskom in electricity, and the other departments which participate in that would then have to make sure that there's appropriate investment that happens in distribution as well as in recirculation, because recirculation, for example, is not in Eskom, and not all distribution is within Eskom. On the expansion of the logistics system, they would be really watching the work that gets done by Transnet as part of the freight master plan. That's the word that I've forgotten. And then you'll be watching the investment that's been undertaken by Transnet in the pipeline from Gauteng to Durban. And in fact, most of the big problems in it, as far as that's concerned, have been resolved, which were really the pricing, the cost of the tariff for the pipeline. There's a project which we haven't included, which actually straddles the infrastructure development cluster as well as the economic development cluster. And this is the broader project and the review of state-owned enterprises in totality. And this is beyond just the network providers, but also to just manufacturing state-owned enterprises. Other areas where we will continue to contribute as a department is in as far as the Department of Water Affairs program to upgrade and increase water infrastructure, we participate in that to ensure that at least all of ESCOM's needs are taken care of in all of those in that investment program. We also need to ensure, and this will be doing in partnership with other departments, that there are policies and guides to guide the implementation of infrastructure projects so that you can ensure that every single inch of government spend does build local capacity, that we are maximizing the skills that we can develop, and that also there is a job intensity in the design and in the setting of projects from external enterprises. And a first point would be to try and see if we can get a competitive supply development program, at least adopted by virtually every single state-owned enterprise that's owned by the state, not only the ones that report to the Department of Public Enterprises. We've also set up a team which, in the case of energy, we work with the Forum of Energy Executives to respond to the challenge of climate change and to develop mitigation strategies by the various sectors that we have responsibility for. And as part of the awareness and education campaign for energy efficiency, one project that we've been running with from the department is the one that replaces diesel with solar water heating, which actually is a major contributor to the system. We thought we should, the one question that also is increasingly coming up is why does the state use state-owned enterprises, and why, in effect, because the obvious of the question would be, why don't you use government departments? One of the key advantages of a company is that it actually is able to have its own balance sheet, which is uses to get into the capital market to make money on its own. It's one of the reasons why some people may see guarantees as not a significant contributor to state-owned enterprises, but they are effectively quite a significant risk in the end, as contingent liabilities to the process, and you do want to get to a point where the state-owned enterprises have no explicit guarantees whatsoever from the process. Then you're talking about very strong companies that are able to engage and act in the market separate from the process. There's also the point that as companies, they're able to enter into commercial partnerships with the private sector, because it's two like entities entering into partnership. It's a lot easier. And then also, the point of being able to leverage commercial tools and incentives to ensure that there's management discipline in the running of the enterprise is actually quite a critical point for why you use state-owned enterprises and not end up using basically the fiscal, because effectively you create a government department, and there's a history for movement away from government departments. And actually, in the case of South Africa, another point, Chair, which probably requires a lot of discussion, is the separation that currently exists in the PSMA between Schedule 2 public entities as well as Schedule 3B public entities. But both these are actually commercial businesses, but they're not quite the same commercial business, because the level of influence and effect that the shareholder has is entirely different. In the case of Schedule 3B, they walk in, and all of the SOEs that we are responsible for, they schedule too. And so a lot of the decisions actually are board decisions, and the companies and the shareholder have some points where they are reserved that is for shareholder approval. What we argue is critical for the SOEs to fulfill a developmental role is that they have to be strong enterprises. We would argue that the question, strong enterprises would be adequately capitalized, so they would have strong balance sheets. They would have predictable cash flows going forward, and that's why the regulatory environment is absolutely crucial. And a regulatory environment that is not designed only for state-owned enterprises, but is designed to also enable private sector players to come in and ensure that they are always the correct signal given, and that the revenue that goes towards state-owned enterprises is absolutely correct. There's no argument about providing subsidies to an economy, but we argue that subsidies must be provided directly from the system. It mustn't be transfers that you actually don't see between the SOE undercharging for a particular service that it provides. Strong boards and management teams are critical. Clear strategic business plans, as well as alignment with labor, is absolutely crucial. And it's an area in our experience where increasingly, and you find in the private sector over time, they've developed better ways of dealing, for example, with issues of labor. And in state-owned enterprises, it's an area of development. Because one of the things that we've argued is that in the end, when you send a state-owned enterprise against a private company, there should be no difference in space for the fact that the rate of return that the shareholder looks for when it's a state-owned enterprise may be defined in a totally different fashion to what the rate of return would be for the private sector. But in terms of operating philosophy, operating culture, there must be alignment. And so one of the things that we've argued is that all SOEs must be in compliance with all of the BE codes in the country, both the sector charters or the guidelines that come from the department. It is then also important that the SOE in its strength is able to be responsive to government's strategic objectives. But what is even more critical is that government is clear about its strategic intent, and that it gives correct signals and does not ever provide confusing signals, because it's when you provide confusing signals that tension arises. What are the challenges that we see as the department? First of all, it's the definition of the role of SOEs in the national economic strategy, and in particular, in terms of what is the role of state-owned enterprises in industrial policy. And it's an area that we must progress a discussion with the Department of Trade and Industry, the Department of Economic Development, so that that is explicitly indicated going forward. But right now, there's a reference, but there isn't an explicit formulation of what that role is. The other challenge is that generally a lot of them have actually had a non-commercial history, and you're moving them towards a commercial history is a challenge, and that's difficult. The capitalization of the SOEs. Recall that the SOEs that DPE landed up with were always the SOEs that were intended for privatization or for sale. No shareholder ever put money into a company that they plan to dispose of. So there's quite a lot of work that has to go on, and it will probably take some time before we get to a point where all of the SOEs that we're responsible for are adequately capitalized, especially in the current economic environment. The next challenge is that there is an infrastructural deficit in South Africa, investment deficit in South Africa, and a large chunk of this is supposed to be carried by the SOEs, which already have weak balance sheets. Means that a lot of work has got to go in terms of better defining partnerships with the private sector going forward. There's also the problem, I'm not sure I use the word disenabling, but I'd also say that there are some policy conflicts in terms of the operations of SOEs that need to be dealt with and need to ensure that actually once there's alignment and as far as that's concerned, you are able to have an SOE that has clarity in terms of its operations. In the case of energy, fortuitously, in the last year, there's quite a lot of areas that we've actually dealt with to ensure that there's greater clarity on policy and alignment between the policy and strategic objectives of the government. And then the last point is this point about DPE as a shareholder, shareholder manager. What are its powers? But here, really reflecting some of the, I suppose, the fragmentation that's introduced by the PFMA, where there are powers assigned to the Minister of Finance and there are powers which are assigned to the shareholder ministry, to the shareholder minister. And sometimes there's some degrees of overlap in the process concerned. What are the things that have we been doing to ensure that there is going to be talks that look almost like English when you say that? But it's been quite important to sort of like move away from a shareholder manager who's almost worried about the administrative side of the enterprises. And this is clear mandate, you have governance systems that are clear, and then effective performance management. In a sense, that this sort of like pigeonhole us as a shareholder manager in an almost more distant relationship to the enterprise than actually would even ever be the case in the private sector. Because even in the private sector, you would normally have a holding company, and there are very clear responsibilities in the holding company and things that are always approved directly by the holding company. In our case, sometimes we've actually had to have some tensions between ourselves and the SOE, where the SOE and the board are of the view that we are getting into territory which is not ours. So there are quite a lot of areas that we're now starting to review which we believe the shareholders should have sight of. For example, if an SOE is going into the capital markets to borrow money, before it signs the covenants, covenants are commitments that the SOE makes to its borrowers that I will not restructure the company. Well, the management and the board can't commit to that. That's the shareholder responsibility on whether we will or will not restructure the company. They then commit that we will not sell a particular operation. That's not their responsibility, it's the shareholder responsibility. So these are some of the areas that need to be defined, because in the current context, those are areas where the shareholder does not have a say, because, for example, borrowing powers of the entity are between the board and the other party, which actually has sign-off on that, is the Minister of Finance. We just have facts. We don't have, the Minister of Public Enterprises doesn't have the right to go and say, no, you can't do that, because she's not appropriately empowered in the current dispensation. So in as far as changing the mandate to be much more an active shareholder, we are setting up guidelines and practices on how some of these things get undertaken. It's been quite useful that in the current environment, a lot more actually of the financial sector are now approaching us and saying, look, we do think that a covenant that looks like this is a bit problematic. Maybe we should agree that whenever we get a covenant that looks like this, we should insist that the SOE must get shareholder approval first. So there is a lot more work that we're doing to ensure. Exactly. No difference. And in fact, the banks behave like a survivor. The issue of alignment between then the role of the SOE and the national economic strategy, and that's why we said that challenge of ensuring that that's absolutely clear must be resolved. The performance of the DCE portfolio. One of the things that we should do here at some point is just to show you Isibugo, which is the dashboard that they use to do oversight of the, to undertake oversight of the SOE on a quarterly basis, where we watch what's happening right across each of the SOEs. Yeah, in the mirror. And it, unfortunately, like the mirror, you look at the past. It doesn't quite help you look at the future yet. We've got to figure out what that is. And then also the creation of an enabling environment for the SOEs. And yeah, that's where, and in fact, often, and that's the biggest question that we often get as DPE. And in the question of, do SOEs belong in a specialist shareholder minister, or they belong into a policy department, that arises because more often than not, sometimes, there is a tense relationship of necessity between the DPE and the policy department. Because the policy department will say, this is what must happen. But we're responsible for a company, go back and you say, but it doesn't make sense. It can't happen like that. And so that often leads to sort of like tensions where you sort of like arguing out in the rest of your life. That is seen by others as counterproductive. But we would argue that actually ensures that the policy is much stronger on the other side, because you are now able to engage with players who are responsible for companies directly in the economy. Chair, if I may, the rest of the details that follow actually just detail how we are refining and changing some of our practice to align with this new sense of what DPE does, if you don't mind. What is about your time, really? I want to come to the role of the DG. To the DG, the one role that I would wish to be input in here, which I think is the role, is troubleshooting. Because invariably, there's always something or the other happening with state-owned enterprises at any given time. And to a large extent, over and above making sure that we've got a clear strategy, that all of us are marching for similar tools, and that work has been done in the department, and ensuring that we are engaging with the state-owned enterprises. The point that I referred to earlier about information asymmetry between ourselves, there's information asymmetry between ourselves and the management team, between the board and management. But the one thing that we've discovered is that we've actually got much more information than the board is ever going to have, because it's our full-time job. And so one of the things that we've got to, and I was saying about this, we've got to get better at being able to watching the data, and in these regular engagements with SOE chairs, SOE CEOs, and also talking to players in the market, we start to have a better sense of how the environment is changing and how the changes in the environment are going to affect the operations of the SOE, so that you can be able to see the fund. I think I am there, Chair.
Yes. I was about to ask whether members are still on board and whether the Minister and the Deputy Minister would like to make any intervention, and whether you propose that we should allow you to go ahead with your, or whether we should take comments and questions as you say. I'm just worried that we might overwhelm members. And in fact, I did not point out in the beginning of the meeting that we are all brand new. I don't know from the DA, I might be making a mistake, apart from the DA. Most of us are new on this portfolio, so you'll have to tread very carefully and slowly, and also to clarify the issue of the autumn school, that it will actually this time be the spring school, and a school in which you will take us through all the things that you do when you oversee all these SOEs and help us to do our work better, but before that spring school in September, we expect you also to take us through to enable us to do our work. I saw a DA chap, I don't want to call you DA chap, you've got names, so is there anything you wanted to say, any intervention you wanted to make? I saw your hand.
I would just like to propose that we move through the presentation in total before we start asking questions, because some of the questions might be answered in the presentation process.
Yeah, I just need to make sure that members are on board. So I don't get an indication that anybody is left behind, so we will continue the presentation. Thanks. And over to you for sharing the minister.
My recommendation, I mean, at this point in the presentation, really, we were going to sort of like indicate briefly the structure of the department. We have three SOE-facing units, which are clustered by enterprise type of business support. There's energy broadband, energy and broadband. There's a transport, as well as the manufacturing sector. This is not in case. So those three, basically, are responsible for the monitoring and analysis of these state-owned enterprises, both the performance through the KPIs, what are the risks that are arising within that enterprise, and what are the capabilities that the enterprise has or requires some support on. And then would provide recommendations on appropriate actions to the DG Minister and the Deputy Minister for action. And then also, which actually are the key points of interface between the policy departments. So it would be the DDGs and those teams who must make sure that if, for example, you're responsible for Transnet, you have a direct relationship with the Department of Transport, we understand what policy changes are happening, what challenges there may be, so that, and also what challenges the policy department has with the state-owned enterprise, so that we are then able to engage with the state-owned enterprise and ensure that it is appropriately responding to the challenges. We're going to be establishing an economic analysis unit, and a large part of what we need to get to is to get alignment in planning assumptions between the state-owned enterprises as well as the government, and particularly the new National Planning Commission. One of the challenges that we've found over the years, and especially when, if you recall, when we moved from what were the projections of growth in the economy from 4%, from around 4% at the time, yes, 4.6, when ESGESA was introduced and the target was 6%, there was a gap between the 4.6 and the SOEs moving to 6%. But also when we move to 6%, we then discover that we actually just don't want to move to 6%. Because when we move to 6%, we suddenly have a massive investment program. And when you look at the balance sheet of the SOE, you can't fund the 6%. And then you suddenly see where the bottleneck starts would arise in the economy. In fact, at the current juncture with the bill program that we have, the ESCOM one, if accelerated, is able to meet 6%. But because of the financial crisis that we were hit with and the current demand, it's been decelerated in effect, so that you are back to around the 4% GDP growth rate if you look at the relationship. So these challenges, this you want a team that's actually constantly on the lookout to ensure that there are changes in the environment, what do we do, and then come back and indicate, I suppose, to the Planning Commission, what are the challenges going to be if you're going to meet 6%, because then now we have a better sense of being able to indicate to the bottleneck at this point, because this is only so much that we can fund directly ourselves. The KPF is a unit that we've had for some time, which is a joint project facility, and here we try to create where we work in projects which require more than one state or an enterprise at any given time. And in fact, it's from JTS that we were able to have broadband InfraCode developed, because we then had the fiber cable investments that were undertaken by Transnet and that were undertaken by ESCOM at the time when we were going to have a third national operator, which was not, which was underutilized, which we were then able to put together and then create this new company, which is now providing capacity in Philly Ford and General Times. And then there's the legal services unit, which provides legal and transactional services to the department, commentary, and in fact, one of the shareholders' responsibilities are in PSMA, and in certain of the transactions, they would provide advisory and do the review of the documentation. Increasingly, we provide guarantees. We then, this is the unit that would work with the Department of Finance or the National Treasury to ensure that the guarantee that in effect is provided by the Minister of Public Enterprises and co-signed by the National Treasury is aligned with the laws and that we are actually not unduly exposed. And then there's the operations unit, which provides the support services, and Shireen and Sandy will talk to that unit strategy. That's where I was planning to stop, Chair, and then let the various units start to do that. But if you can all just indicate your name of the chair. Chair, my recommendation would be probably to, and I think it's a matter of questions. I imagine that most of the questions that members want to ask are about the SOEs themselves. But the direction of the presentation is about our strategy and our business plan. So maybe if we find a way of having a comfortable accommodation of the questions that members would like to ask about the company and the questions which just relate to the strategy itself.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. We'll take you through, our DG is just taking you through the structure of the GPE. We've done a high-level organizational structure, which supports what she's just presented to you.
We need your name also for our record purposes, but we need to know who you are also.
Morning, Chair. Sandy Hutchings, CFO of GPE. We'll carry on to the next page, which is the budget of the DPE. My apologies, I'm not used to using these fancy things. We'll move on to the budget, which is really a very high-level presentation of our budget. We've presented to you appropriation per program and a small explanation below that where it illustrates how our budget decreases from last year, which we've illustrated as well, 3.3 million to... Sorry, I haven't got my glasses on. the decline is basically due to the reduced transfer payments to the SOE, and in 2011-12 you will see that no transfer payments are reflected there. These transfer payments were approved in previous years and reflect what was approved in the MTEP. At this moment in time, we are going to be preparing the MTEP for the coming 3 years, and we may see a change to that if any funding is required for the SOE in the coming years. The operational budget remains within the baseline over the period and is linked to the business plans of the unit. You will notice that administration also remains very static. And if you go to the, we'll move on to the next slide, which gives you the appropriation for economic classification of the department. And essentially, this will change during this financial year. We were not anticipating having a deputy minister in the department, and therefore, particularly under compensation, goods and services, that will change during the period, this current period. And then obviously in the MTEP that will be provided for over the next 3 years. We've also presented to you the summary of transfer payments to the SOE over the period under review. This actually outlines, if we go back to the first slide, the transfer payments are included within each program where they reside. And for clarity and for ease of reference, we have presented to you the transfer payments over the period for each individual SOE. And as I said, this is what was approved in previous years, and could change during the coming MTEC period if the need arises or if there are approvals or requests for funding over the period. That covers, I think, the budget at a very high level for the members.
Thank you, Chair. If I may move on. My name is Shireen Coffin, and I head up corporate services in DTE. The slide on the DTE HR statistics is really just an overview of the resources of the department. We started off with a brief, just a comparison of 2008 to 2009, and nothing much has really changed in the structure. You'll notice that we had a full establishment of 163 and 141 full posts in 2008. We present the current stats as of 8 June 2009, which is a full establishment of 164 posts. We've got full posts of 138, vacancies to date 26, and we've got two of those at interview stage with 10 being advertised. We've had 28 new appointments in the period, 1 April 2008 to date. So it's just going over the full cycle, which is a total of 15 months. And there's a breakdown just in terms of the levels. That would be from SMS down to the lower levels in the department. We've had exits of 27 in the department, which is quite reflective of some of the issues that we deal with regarding challenges of both attracting and retaining skills. But I don't think it's pertinent only to DPE, but to the public sector as a whole. Our vacancy rate, our current vacancy rate is 15%, which you will agree is quite high. We've compared that to the public sector vacancy rate, which is an overall rate, and there's for the public sector 22% in total. We've got a turnover rate, which I've reflected both for the full period, 1 April 2008, which covers the full cycle to the end of the cycle, being 31 March 2009, at 15.6%. That as opposed to the public sector turnover rate of 18%. I've just taken a further breakdown to show the current status of that turnover rate, which would be from 1 April to the current date, which is 3.59%. That study. In terms of our equity set, there's a lot of information on the slide which you can go through yourself. But an important point is just that on most of the targets that are set by SASSA, we've more or less reached those targets, far from one or two areas where we are below the targets that have been set. In terms of our disability set, GPSA set us at a target of 2%. Internally, the DG has determined a target of 4% previously, which we have reached. So we have six disabled people in the department. However, that target has just been up, and we are aiming for 6% in our department. If you just go on to the content block just below the table, the important stat here is the gender compilation at SMS level, which is something that public sector watches quite closely. The target is 50-50, and we are currently at 52% male and 47% female. Obviously, here, because we are a small department, every time a female SMS member leaves the department, it affects these stats quite hugely. So that's something that we watch quite closely in terms of our recruitment. We move on. Just in terms of our internship and graduate development program, we thought it would be important to highlight this because of the scarcity of skills that we as a department face, especially in the specialist areas that we've got to look at. Our interns for 2008, we had 22 interns. We watch quite closely the interns' movement after they leave the department. Obviously, we can't retain them in the department because we've got to make space for the next set of interns. But we've appointed 3 last year of our intake of 22, and 11 of the interns moved on. They were either transferred or, sorry, found employment in other public sector organizations or in private sector. Currently, we have an intake of 22 interns for the current period. We embarked on the graduate development program last year, and we put 4 graduates through university, focusing mainly on BCom honours and becoming to our financial analyst sector in the BCE. And of those 4, they've been employed in the BCE this year. So that's a program that's continuously on the way, and we've delivered the next intake. Thank you.
Yeah, I think it's the energy.
Okay. Sorry, I have a bit of a sore throat, and fortunately my contribution is limited. Just to indicate that, my apologies. I'm Sandra Kutsira, and I'm responsible for investment and portfolio management at DDG level in the DG's office. So the DG's office, along with the ministry and all the support staff functions, are grouped together in Program 1 Administration. You will note, with reference to the third bullet, the Office of the Chief Investment and Portfolio Manager, that is what I will be speaking to. In essence, Chair and members of the House, the role of the CIPM is to collect, aggregate, analyze and communicate relevant information relating to the state of health of the SOE portfolio that DPE is responsible for, as well as the environment within which those SOEs operate. In essence, the role of the CIPM is to serve as an integrator, harmonizer, enhancer of the shareholder management processes which the DG shared with you earlier on. In the process of aggregating the information that relates to the different SOEs from a portfolio level, we are then able to also detect cross-cutting shareholder risks. And our responsibility is then also to propose solutions to mitigating solutions to those risks, and to track the implementation mitigating responses to those risks. In addition, we provide strategic advice to the Minister, the DG and the SOE facing teams based on the information that we aggregate and the analysis that we conduct. Finally, we develop key frameworks to enhance the focus and coherence of the shareholder management process, and in particular, to use an example of what the CRPM office delivers. The Isibuku dashboard is one of the tools that the CRPM office has developed thus far to improve our ability to execute our shareholder management functions. In consequence, the objective of the CRPM office is to manage the portfolio and its investments in such a manner that we can show to our stakeholder community, both within government and outside, that progressively we are able to improve the value creation through our investment in state-owned enterprises, as well as reduce the exposure of the fiscus across the portfolio of our investments. And that we hope to do through practice, shareholder management practices that, first of all, induce commercial sustainability of the SOE. This is a matter that the DG has already spoken to. Secondly, that we can demonstrate that our shareholder management practices allow us to optimize cross-portfolio benefits towards industrialization, skills development, and increased employment opportunities and broad-based black economic empowerment. And then finally, that the capital investment program that we undertake through our state-owned enterprises are integrated and synergetic with other network infrastructure investments undertaken by the state. The DG has already shared with you on a different slide the key components of the shareholder management process, and I'm not going to repeat that. What I would like to highlight to the committee is the fact that there's a logical cycle within which that process is undertaken, and a key focus of our new mission statement is particularly the extent to which intergovernmental consultations assist us in precisioning the strategic intent statement that we issue to the SOE. A key focus is the clarity of purpose and the clarity of communication between the shareholder and the enterprise with regard to purpose and delivery. So the CRPM office would in essence be an interface between the DG and the SOE facing teams to ensure that there's alignment, harmonization, and depth in analysis, allowing ourselves to communicate clearly to the SOE what we expect and how their performance is measuring up to the delivery expectations. What I would also like to highlight for the interest of this committee is that the steps depicted from this block up to here are all statutory obligations that have to be executed within specified time frames, either in the BFMA or in the Companies Act. Of course, the intergovernmental consultations and the strategic intent statements aren't statutory requirements at this point in time, but are critical in ensuring that the link between expectations, government, national economic expectations, and delivery is achieved. Consequently, Chair and members of the committee, for the current financial year, a key focus of the CRPM office will be to enhance the synchronization and precision of this logical framework of planning, monitoring and evaluation between the National Economic Planning Framework and SAE delivery. And for that purpose, his focus will be to ensure that the strategic intent statements issued by the department are synchronized with the planning cycles of the state-owned enterprises. To be specific, in essence, we need to ensure that by the time that the SAE starts preparing the corporate plans, that we as shareholders have communicated what we consider to be the strategic intent for that SAE's current planning year, and that strategic intent statement is sufficiently clear to be effective. We also intend ensuring that the shareholder contracts are also synchronized with the SAE planning framework, as well as sufficiently detailed across the portfolio so that we can actually measure performance comparatively between the different SAEs as well. We also want to improve the quality of the SAE corporate plan and intend issuing a guideline to improve the content of that. We will expand the Isibuku dashboard. At this point in time, we are collating information with regard to financial, operational, infrastructure investment and developmental objectives. We intend improving the population of data in relation to those fields across all the SAEs. We also intend improving our benchmarking, which we already commenced, at an industry sector and national economic level, with the intent of ensuring that our performance and evaluation is referenced to companies of a similar type and size globally, as well as in the national economy, that it corresponds with sector expectations in terms of performance, and also to monitor the impact of, for example, the current economic downturn on the performance of the SAEs, and to have a better sense of what risks those SAEs will be facing in terms of the economic context that they're operating in. We intend improving our response to the SAE board in terms of preparing investor briefs, giving them a clear indication of where we believe their performance is measuring up to expectation, where it's deviating from expectation, as well as what we consider to be forecasted areas of risk requiring the attention of the board. And then we will continue our shareholder risk management framework, detection, monitoring and mitigating across the different SAEs. In addition, we will complete work that we commenced in the previous financial year in relation to the development of a capitalization and dividend policy. In the previous financial year, we developed a financial model on capital, ideal capital structure for the state-owned enterprises that we're responsible for. We will take the results of that work towards a framework that we believe could apply across all SAEs in terms of defining a capitalization and dividend policy. Also in the previous financial year, we started the process of consolidating and defining clear guidelines with regard to share subscriptions at the time when we capitalized an SAE, what the appropriate procedure for share subscription would be. The same with regard to shareholder loans and guarantees, laying down a clear guideline in terms of process and content. And we've also started with the establishment of a shareholder and guarantee office, where all the records related to the exposure of the department are kept for safekeeping. We will also, for this particular with the Office of the Chief Financial Officer, we and the SAE facing team, we developed the MCEF application. With this particular MCEF application, will in particular require a very clear view of the SAE priorities in relation to national funding priorities and measures taken to improve the financial health of the SAE. We will also undertake a study in terms of the economic regulatory framework for network infrastructure to improve the cohesion of those frameworks. As a matter of course, we provide specialist advisory services to the Ministry, the DG, and the SAE Basin team. And then we will continue with our work in relation to implementation of the risk of Southeast of Settlement, which affects Alex Corps, and as a consequence of the implementation thereof, we will assess Alex Corps' commercial future and assist in the redirection of its future towards sustainability. I hand over now to Corporate Services to continue the administration. Madam Chair, no, it's still part of Program 1.
I wonder if, with due respect to corporate services, it's a standard corporate services provision. I wonder if we couldn't just skip through that and not cover that now and go on to Program 2, which is the energy and water.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Chris Foley. I'm the DDG responsible for energy and broadband. So what we're supposed to do for all the new members of the committee is, just to indicate, we have three SOE that this program oversees. It's ESCOM, the Pebble Bed Modular Reactor, and Broadband Infraco. And our purpose really is to ensure that their corporate strategy, well, not just the strategy, but the implementation thereof, is aligned to government strategic intent and in order to monitor their performance in respect of financial and operations. I'll just put this in, just to try and get a bit of context. This is the national grid that ESCOM oversees. It's about 366,000 kilometers of power lines and total power station nominal capacity is around 43,000 megawatts. As you can see, it spans the breadth and width of the country. I'll put this pointer. This big red line is the one that comes down to the Western Cape. And that's the one that we generally have problems on when one of the Cooper units go down and it's the middle of winter because it's not able to transfer enough capacity from all these little red dots, which are the coal-fired power stations, down to the Western Cape. Most of those big red lines are being upgraded and they should be complete within the next year or so, barring some environmental being able to appropriate some of the land that you have to go through. So just to give you a snapshot of ESCOM, we obviously will do something a bit more in-depth over time. Just in terms of InfraCo has two parts. One is called the National Backbone, which is a terrestrial network that runs across the country. And these are the fiber optic cables that were run by ESCOM with its power line and also by Transnet along the railway line, which InfraCo actually took over. And they took over about 5,800 kilometers of line in 2005. And they've actually expanded it by pretty much double to date to 12,000 kilometers to make it a proper network provision because you have to put in rings for redundancy, et cetera, in case lines go down and you don't have a sustainable electricity almost. And they've also increased the capacity of these lines about six times since they actually took it over. The other one, which was signed on the 8th of April, and which we're quite excited about, is the submarine cable, which provides international connectivity. So the previous one actually provides, it's like a highway between your cities, and this cable is essentially your link to the outside world. And as the DG mentioned, we intervene in areas where there is market failure or monopolies that are not working correctly. And these are the two areas that were identified in telecommunications that are a bottleneck or an obstacle to greater access and lower pricing of broadband, is the international and the terrestrial between cities. So this is the PMR reactor concept. Essentially, PMR is a reactor. It's like a big kettle, a bit more complicated than a big kettle, but it's a big kettle essentially. It produces heat, and with that heat, you can do a number of things. You can use the steam, much the same as a coal boiler, to produce electricity, or you can actually take that steam and use it in processes. And Sasol would be one of the other producers, or you can use it to do things like extract oil from sand, where there's oil in the sand. You heat the sand and the oil comes out. And so this is just a picture to give you. This is the fuel, this gray ball. It's about the size of two golf balls for those who play golf. And then these little particles are embedded in a number of layers of carbon and other materials. This is now to prevent radiation from getting out. And just to direct you, each of these balls is embedded in the larger ball, and there's a few thousand in there. And then that makes up the actual fuel. And what they do is they cycle these balls through the reactor, and as they do that, they radiate it and it creates heat. And that's an X-ray of one of them, a cutaway. It's uranium. This is uranium, yeah. And it's graphite, the outside of graphite. So this is a research, or it's a project that's been developed, and they are revising the business model for this, because originally it was a very high-tech, academic-type project. And looking at it more commercially, if we just look at it as a heat source, you're able then to append onto it either a steam generator or an electricity generator. So that's just a snapshot of the three. If we can just go to the next slide and just run through some of the unit's priorities for 2019. We have a number of slides after this that I won't go through that are the detail of the business plan. So what we've done is I've extracted the main elements of that, and you can go through that at your leisure, and feel free to raise questions on the detail, but I'll do this and then I'll do the budget. So the first thing for us is ensure that the three SOEs achieve their targets. And when you say targets, it's essentially the targets set in the shareholder compact by the end of the year. And we do this by monitoring continually and then providing annual assessments also on that. Big in terms of infrastructure is Eskom's build program and the InfraCo rollout of the West African cable system. We need to ensure that they deliver as planned. And the big issues going forward are really on funding and to take corrective action when necessary or we are able is I think something we need to look at going forward. Also looking at this development and implementation of a short-term funding solution for the Eskom capital expenditure program, very topical currently with the NERSA hearings that are going on with the interim application. And then a correct funding model for the medium to longer term going forward based on revalued assets and a reasonable return on assets, which really should look at something like the cost, the weighted average cost of capital for the organization, but a utility rate of return. And then also, what's important is to look at mitigating risk in this current economic climate that we're in, and in light of the declining revenues, and then restricted access to debt in the environment we find ourselves, just to make sure that we don't burden the fiscus unnecessarily. And then, for PVMR, or Pebble Modular Reactor, important that they develop this new business plan and funding model and also implement it. And then the nuclear process for the conventional nuclear, which is not pebble-based, but it's also nuclear, which Eskom discontinued the procurement process last year. We have to develop the framework this year to select a technology partner and a fleet provider going forward. And we've given ourselves essentially the year to do that. So with those, I'm actually going to jump to slide 61, because this is the detail of the business plan which you can peruse at your leisure. And then if we go to our budget for the unit for the year, if you look at the, for the NSEP period, essentially from last year to this year, the compensation of employees increases by about 9%. Goods and services by about $500,000. And then the transfer payments of 1.9 billion are broken up into 1.74 billion for PVMR and then 208 million for the broadband InfraCo. And then as you can see, in the second year of this current incident that we're going into, there's only a transfer payment for InfraCo, the last bit of that. And then nothing yet going forward. But they obviously, depending on what happens with the Infoco TBMR business plan and how we go forward, we may have to apply for additional money. That's the end of program two.
Morning, Madam Chair and Honourable Members. My name is Michelle Impoff. I'm the Acting DDG for the Manufacturing Unit. Essentially, I look after what we can refer to as the guns and roses in the department, where Bilal makes the guns, and well, forestry, to some extent, their flower, and those are the roses in the department. Just similar to what Chris has said, the purpose of the unit is to make sure that the SOE strategies are aligned to government strategic intent and to develop proposals around how SOEs can play a key role in the growth of the manufacturing sector, as well as to monitor and advise on their financial performance going forward.
Mm-hmm.
I'll start off by just giving a brief overview of the SOEs. That essentially there's Denal, which is a key technology-based company, playing predominantly in the defense sector. It plays in both the aerospace sector, where there's Denal Aviation, which does the MRO activities for the armed forces, specifically for the African Air Force. Then there's Denal Food Aerostructures, which is involved in the manufacture of various parts and components on the structures of airplanes. Then on the land systems, there's Denal Land Systems based in Driselton, which is involved predominantly in the manufacturing of artillery and turrets. Other businesses, which is based in Denal Missiles as well, Denal Dynamics, which makes missiles and manned vehicles, as well as contains the integration and system solutions for the within the Denal group. Denal's key capabilities is really in the R&D and engineering of parts and components, and this is a capability which is highly recognized by foreign players, both manufacturing companies and other people who come and to and visit Denal and have commented on the quality of their engineering capability, the quality of the products that have been developed within the Denal family of companies. And it's essentially the role that Denal plays is to supply certain strategic defense capabilities to South African armed forces. That's something I'll touch on in the terms of the priorities for the department. Because there's no way where Denal can supply all the capabilities to the South African Defence Forces, and neither we're asking the Defence Forces to do that. But there still is a role where Denal will need to provide certain supply of those capabilities, so in a way to secure security of supply for certain capabilities of the armed forces. Secondly, we're looking for Denal to generate some spillover benefits to the rest of the manufacturing company sector of the economy, specifically in terms of advanced manufacturing. I'll quickly just go over this slide. I've already highlighted the Denal Group companies, but I'll also highlight that a key component of the Denal strategy is to enter into strategic equity partners with foreign companies that can provide it with access to export markets, as well as bring in certain industrialization operational expertise to the businesses. In terms of SAFCO, SAFCO is 100% state-owned forestry company, which owns assets, predominantly forestry assets reside in KLF, which also owns forestry assets in Mozambique, known as the Floma. The location of the forests are in Mpumalanga and Mpopo and the KZN province, and it's predominantly for saw log production, which compared to other forests has got a 30-year rotation. So it's not as attractive for private sector companies to participate in, because you have to wait for 30 years to effectively get your money, as opposed to 8-12 years offered by software production. And secondly, it has a sawmill in the Limpopo province, but as a department, we've encouraged Safcol not to integrate vertically like other companies in the forestry sector. In total, it has 1,877 hectares of land, of which roughly 125 hectares is planted. And as I've mentioned, predominantly it's for pine, which is used for saw log production. And its main mandate is to maintain the sustainability of commercial plantation forests to supply saw logs to the industry. Just to highlight its importance to the country, as I mentioned, the type of logs that's in, on a 30-year rotation. So whilst in terms of total forestry plantation in South Africa, SAFCOL will only have a very small proportion, but in terms of saw logs, it owns 40% of the saw log plantations in the country. And specifically in the regions where it operates, it will be the dominant company within that sector. Secondly, because SAFCOL is not vertically integrated, it's a key supply to other sawmills within the forestry sector. So it has a huge, a significant impact